It's a real great pleasure to introduce Professor Erik Rietveld as our first speaker. Erik is the Socrates Professor at the University of Amsterdam across the Department of Philosophy and Brain and Cognition. He is a founding partner of RAAAF, Rietveld Architecture Art Affordances, which has an extraordinary record of artistic and architectural interventions, including work at the Venice Biennale. Erik is also, in recent years, Socrates Professor at the University of Twente, working on technology and clothing. Just most recently, or last year, I guess it is now, a special issue of the journal Adaptive Behavior was devoted to Erik's work with a huge swathe of commentaries and responses. It showed, I guess, the range of Erik's work from the foundations of philosophy of mind and cognitive science to extremely applied interventions in art and in public policy, and the range of methods that he's worked in. So, Erik, thank you so much for opening the conversation today with your talk on landscapes of transformation.
The reason that I wanted to talk about that is because I think in this time of all these societal challenges that we're facing, from climate change to species extinction to new disruptive technologies to war in Europe, there's a lot of transformation going on and transformation needed. I think there is something to learn from the arts about how we can deal with complex societal issues, and that's what I've been trying to do over the last few decades. I'm one of the founders of RAAAF, which is an artist collective. We make art installations using the skills of architects, so it's typically very large works of art in public space, but also for biennales, museum. Now you will see examples later on. I founded RAAAF together with my brother, Ronald Rietveld. Now you will see a lot of RAAAF later on. I decided to focus mostly on RAAAF's work because there's a lot of cultural heritage involved. It has a close link to memory, of course, and less on the philosophical part of my work. But there is some hardcore philosophical ideas as well, for those of you who like that. But first, some of RAAAF projects, Bunker 599, which we did together with Atelier de Lyon. It's working on the new Dutch waterline, which is UNESCO World Heritage since 2 years now. It was a defense line that tried to keep the armies that wanted to attack the Netherlands from the east out by inundating, flooding the landscape. There's these bunkers as remainders. And for instance, this bunker, which is in the center of the Netherlands, was a municipal monument and listed UNESCO World Heritage. And then we decided that it would be nice to cut it open, to slice it open, and to show how these bunkers look on the inside. Now you can imagine, since you all know we are in a monument here, and we're not even allowed to open the curtain. So you can imagine how the monument authorities were responding when we said, okay, this is a municipal monument, but we want to cut it anyway. It took 5 years using this image to convince them. So what we tried to do, speaking of imagination, is often to make an image that shows what we would like to do, to make people enthusiastic and to get them with us. There's no one coming to us asking, do you want to cut a monument? No, we come up with the idea, and then we try to gather people that think that it might be interesting. And why would it be interesting? Why would it be interesting to cut a monument? And I think that's because this way, this old-fashioned conservatist way of dealing with monuments has also disadvantages. If you have 400 of these bunkers in the new Dutch waterline that are all being conserved, people basically don't pay attention to them anymore. And we think that you can keep it more to life by transforming some of the historical heritage in artworks. And that's what we did. Here's the first cut. And this is the guy who had been cutting. So it took us 5 years to get permission and all the things arranged for cutting it, whereas cutting the reinforced concrete of the bunker took 1 year with a diamond saw. 1 year, I said 1 year, but it's 1 month. This is the guy who did the cutting. Here you see the result. The bunker is now officially UNESCO World Heritage as part of the new Dutch water line. And we were very happy with that because it basically shows that also UNESCO, so not just the Dutch monument authorities, but also UNESCO, are open to embracing this new way of dealing with monuments that place imagination first. You get an insight in the bunker. So by cutting one open, you get to experience also how the others are on the inside. We call this approach hardcore heritage. And if, for those of you who are interested in it, you can read this paper. It's basically about making imagination prior to cultivation, to conservatism in heritage, and basically trying to show that by transforming heritage in artworks, you can speak more to people and make it attractive for a larger group of people. Then an entirely different project, to give you an idea of what we do at RAAF and the kind of art installations we make. This is Vacant NL, which basically it's the Dutch contribution to the Venice Biennale in 2010, and we were fascinated with the potential of 10,000 vacant public and government buildings, often beautiful buildings like the one we're in now, actually, also often monuments, former schools, former prisons, former police stations, former hospitals, many beautiful buildings. This one was one of them, 10,000 in total. And we wanted to make the exhibition in the Dutch Pavilion. We were invited to represent the Netherlands in the Dutch Pavilion in Venice. And we found out doing historical research, as we always do on site, that the Dutch Pavilion is on Dutch soil in Venice. And the Dutch Pavilion is vacant 9 months a year, more or less, because it's only used during the Biennale. So in total, that was at that time 39 years of vacancy. So the Venice Pavilion, the Dutch Venice Pavilion, was an exemplar of all the vacancy of monuments that we had in the Netherlands. What you also see on this image is that it has beautiful light, and that is what we use as a starting point for the intervention that we wanted to make. We basically made an art installation that kept everything empty, and then we suspended lines at that height that basically looked from below like this. And from above, if you had found the stairs that we also made in it, you would see the entire sea of the 10,000 vacant public and government buildings. And we saw this as basically we wanted to make a call to the Dutch government at this very influential exhibition in the world of art to reuse this vacancy temporarily. Because there's a lot of things being built and built and built, but there's also a lack of reuse of these resources that are there and that could easily be used, for instance, for attracting knowledge workers to the Netherlands from all kinds of countries. And this is what you basically, a map we made. We made the Dutch Atlas of Vacancy, a huge book that showed, it's an atlas this size, that showed all the vacant 10,000 vacant buildings, and that they each have their own affordances, their own possibilities for action, and that there are particular contexts. For instance, here you see a page of the different churches that are vacant, and that they have real action possibilities. Now, this way of thinking in terms of the action possibilities that vacancy offered, it was an inspiration for the paper, which is A Rich Landscape of Affordances, which is a very philosophical paper on the concept of affordances, of possibilities for action that the environment offers. And vacancy offers many, many possibilities. I'll say more about it because it's central to the way of thinking in my kind of philosophy. It's philosophy of embodied cognition that basically takes seriously that the body has been socialized in sociocultural practices, and we take these skills that we have acquired with us in any situation, which is basically why I'm able to speak in English to you at this moment. And here you see some people working, making architecture in this case. One of the long-term philosophical questions that I won't go in, but just that you know the kind of things I'm working on, is can the entire spectrum of things that people do skillfully be understood in terms of responsiveness to affordances? And just to make sure that everyone gets the concept of affordances, I have here this sequence of images that you see someone responding to the affordances of a chair to sit, the affordance of a chair to move it, the affordance of a chair to move it to an appropriate distance for someone that would arrive later. And he's also simultaneously responding to the possibility of an ice cream to hold it. So the entire environment offers many action possibilities, and these are the affordances. So this is, in a sense, affordances is a very simple notion. You were all responding to the affordances of the chairs that you're currently sitting on. Now, one of the things that we did in a paper with Julian Kivestein is trying to enrich the concept of affordances by defining it as relations between aspects of the social material environment, which is always in flux, and abilities available in the ecological niche, for instance, the human ecological niche. So this aspect of the social and material environment affords sitting, but it also affords standing on, and it affords smashing the window if we need, it affords dancing on. So any particular aspect can offer multiple affordances depending of this entire richness of skills that we have in the form of life. And that's also why there's so many affordances in vacant buildings, because there's so many skills that we have in the ecological niche, in the human ecological niche, for instance. So it's a very broad notion. There are affordances for touching, affordances for speaking, affordances for making artworks, etc., etc. And that's one of the things that we are studying in my research group. Now here you see an example of a social affordance. The extended hands affords shaking, and at the same time the person is ignoring the affordances of the chair there on the side. So she's immediately responsive to the relevant affordances in the particular situation. And from our perspective for cognitive science, that is one of the central questions. How can it be that we are immediately responsive to the relevant affordances in any particular situation? So why did none of you sit here, but why did you know that you should sit there? And how does that work? Another example of social affordances are, for instance, in campfire. That offers possibilities for gathering. Could be important if you're interested in social cohesion, because it speaks to people from many different social cultural backgrounds. So you can think of affordances that have the power to bring people from different social cultural backgrounds together. Now, an entirely different project where we wanted to make the concept of affordances tangible for people. In a project that's titled The End of Sitting, and that started by a question from the chief government architect of the Netherlands, if we could imagine the workplace of the future for civil servants. And then we saw that we were living in a sitting society where we sit all the time, like you, most of you are at the moment. We do it in public transport, in schools, universities. We punish children to stand in the corner, so the standing as if it's something bad. And then what we did was to make this this large art installation titled The End of Sitting. What we wanted to show with it is that artistic practices have an openness to the possibility of doing things radically different. And I want to show you a bit of how that is possible. And that's possible by material engagement, as Lambros Malafouras would call it. So we sketch. These are sketches made at the studio, one sketch every day to come up with new ideas. But we also play around a lot with materials, in this case, to find how the environment could support standing and working in non-sitting positions. And it's we call it a material playground. And it's a way of just playfully exploring. Actually, that's Janno, who is here. You may have recognized him. very playful. So you know, if you want to get in touch with someone, it should be Janno, then you can play. And here we are finding something, a position that works for supported standing really well. And then we fixated it, so to say. And we discovered that if you lift the feet, it's even more comfortable. This is like a mock-up to be on the same page, to know what we're going to make together and to find out what problems could be, how you can pass. But it's also all movable. These are more experimental ways of supported working, basically. We tried out many things, carpet, suspended. But the art installation that resulted from it is this one, The End of Sitting. We made it together with the visual artist Barbara Visser. And here you see it in space. And basically the guy here, you may recognize the position he's in. So he's not sitting, but he's supported standing. The reason I'm showing it is, again, to show that artists can have this openness to the possibility of having radically different practices. I showed it in the case of the radically different practices of having different ways of dealing with heritage. And this is a different ways of experiencing how we could live and work in non-sitting ways, a future without chairs that doesn't take that. And basically questioning the taken for granted by making the art installation and inviting people to reflect on their own habits of sitting and imagining how it could be different. And it's also a philosophical exploration. So can we do philosophy also not just by writing text, but also by making art installations, philosophical art installations, as you could call them. Now, one of the advantages of making artworks is that you can ship them to biennales and get the international press. So it's also a nice affordance for talking about the philosophy. For some reason, media are more interested in artwork exhibitions than in philosophical papers. But this is a nice way in. And what it also did, The End of Sitting also invited all kinds of empirical scientists to study what could be the future of the workspace. So we had epidemiologists, ecological psychologists, human movement scientists, all doing their experiments on that End of Sitting art installation. We had ethnographers in the studio to observe the process of making the artwork. We had filmers to document it too. And one of the more ethnographic papers that came out is very interesting if you're interested in a process of account of affordances. So if you're interested in affordances, how they change over time, and you will see quite some examples during my talk, then this paper is something I can recommend. So if you want to radically change the behavior of this group of people, then what you could do is to radically change the landscape of affordances in this space. That's basically what you see materialized here. So far, artistic skills can contribute to imagining how we could live differently. And a way to get to these new ideas of how we could live differently is by creating material playgrounds. Artists are good in having an openness to this possibility of having radically different practices, practices of sitting, practices of doing heritage, etc., etc. And artworks communicate in a different way than philosophical texts. They communicate affectively and experientially rather than just verbally. Now, we are here at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Paris, and Raaf is an artist in residence at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Amsterdam. And one of the discussions that recently took place there is this one on climate change and the role of scientists in it. And what was interesting there is that there's a kind of gap between all the factual knowledge that scientists have of what will be happening in the coming decades, most likely, and how it reaches the broader public, and how it leads or leads not to behavior change and collective behavior change. I think that this is one of the important questions in science at the moment, but also something that I've been interested in personally for a long time, because I come from an area that has had river floods already for centuries. But in 1995, there was a large river flood where part of the family had to be evacuated. Here you see the image from that time. And many of you will remember the tsunami kind of effect, like the tsunami in Japan. So there's this enormous force of water that you experience if you encounter real life floods and the force of water. Now, what I wanted to show you to give you an impression of how the roots of Raaf in landscape architecture have influenced our way of thinking, I wanted to show you the first thing that we did even before RAF was founded, because this is the graduation project that my brother did when graduating at Architecture and Art Academy. It's called the Green River. And basically, it was already in 1998 and 2003 dealing with climate change and basically anticipating what was happening. So this was the model, and now it's getting a bit technical, but not too difficult. So here you see a map of a part of the Netherlands, and there would be, this is a model where there is a break in the dikes, and then you see in blue how many meters of water there will be in the country, up to 6 meters. And my brother Ronald made a plan for this area that is basically a 40 kilometer long bypass for the river system that would become a new landscape park. So imagine 40 kilometers of park, which is huge, of course, in a very densely populated country like the Netherlands. This is how people live. This is the normal kind of green space that they have in many of the areas in the Netherlands. It's very densely populated. And here you see how we lived with the water over time. So in the past, the river, we are a delta in the Netherlands. So the water was just flowing down normally before 1100. Then there was cultivation and dikes were being built. And then we basically canalized very much the rivers in the last centuries. So the rivers got less space. And now what this plan in 2003, so 20 years ago, was proposing, was to make a new space in between the rivers where in times of peak discharge of water, the river could flow. And this is the kind of landscape that you would get. So you would get an enormous empty space in this fully populated, densely populated country that would become like a Zen garden for people in the Netherlands in this urban area of 40 kilometers. So here you see what you could call a dike park, which is basically the contour of where the bypass water would flow. Two or three times in your lifetime, every 20 to four, three to four times in your lifetime on average, every 20 to 40 years. And of course, there's you can imagine that there's all sorts of cultural heritage in this kind of area that would then be made open to be flooded. So everything would be organized for flooding. And there's these beautiful castles and churches. And the idea is to orientate the dike park on these objects of cultural heritage, like here on the church that you see at the end. There would be new kinds of ways of being in the nature. And the kind of structure of the dike park, which is on average 200 meters wide, would depend on the kind of surroundings that you're at. So on top you see here glass houses for agriculture, and then in the middle there's houses, and at the bottom there's a castle. And every time the design of the landscape is attuned to it. For instance, the glass houses need a lot of water, and there will be space for water because drought is also a problem in the Netherlands. Now here you see an aerial image, so to say, of this 42 kilometer long bypass that would then flood every 20 to 40 years. Here you see what happens when flooding happens. This is the normal river flooding, and here you see the bypass flooding. So this enormous emptiness becomes then flooded land every 20 to 40 years. So again, it would be like a Zen garden, but also a Zen garden that could be that could offer all kinds of affordances for urban development, because in such a densely populated country with lack of open space, people would be able to come to live on the edges of this enormous new landscape park. What you see here happening is here you see very clearly how in 2100 the Green River would be, or the open landscape place would then be at the center of this urban development. In 2050 it would attract on the edges, so you would already see clearly the contours. So this is a way of dealing simultaneously with drought and peak rainwater discharges that was done in a way of integrating different disciplines, water management, landscape architecture, and dealing with the technical part, of course, of it, which I didn't show, how to build it. Then finally, a very new project where you may see some of the kind of themes coming back, like emptiness and what we call poetry of absence, taking things away rather than adding things. It's called DeltaWerk/, which we made together with Atelier de Lyon. In the Netherlands, there have been enormous floodings. The main one was in the 1950s. And then we built these very strong dikes to keep the sea out. And here, when you look at the cars on the image, you will note that the enormous size of these concrete objects that were necessary for keeping the sea out. Here at the bottom, you see an image of an entire forest where 75 engineers were making all kind of water models for dealing with the floods that could come. So they were building the port of Rotterdam, at least models for it. They were building all kinds of models, but physical models with physical materials in this forest called the water flowing forest. Then at some point, this entire landscape of all these experiments in water management became vacant because the engineers moved out and the nature started to take over. And when they were still there, these are some of the images of how their work would be. This, as I said, it's kill models. So here you see them basically being pretending they are a river boat. Here there's foreign delegations visiting to see the model of their new port, in this case from Nigeria. Another port, I think it's Shanghai. And this is one of the main big objects that was used by the engineers to make tsunami waves and other waves to basically test the constructive strength of these dikes that would be built. It's 250 meters long, this wave machine, and the engineers could make all kinds of waves. Here you get an impression when you look at the person next to it. So it was working for a few decades, and then it became empty. And since we had been collaborating with the Cultural Heritage Agency on the bunker, and although they had at first a lot of resistance, in the end they really embraced the bunker and the way of thinking behind the bunker, of imagination for preservation, they asked us also to come up with an artwork plan for this vacant piece of cultural heritage. And we were fascinated, on the one hand, by the force of water and this ambition by the engineers to build an indestructible Holland in times of climate change, but also by the force of nature, because since the engineers had been gone, nature has been basically taking over again all these models in just like 5 years. So for some period, this forest, this hydrodynamic laboratory, had been leading, and then at some point, when the engineers left, nature became leading, and basically ruin formation happened. When we do work, we always dive into the archives, and we also do a lot of cultural historical research. And in this case, we found this image of the construction of this wave machine, the Delta Flume, as it's called. And you see that there's no earth here against it. But when we found it, there was earth against the wall. So they basically digged it in. And we made a proposal to dig it out again and then to slice it open. And just like with Bunker 599, we made images to show what we wanted to do and to convince people in the Netherlands that it would be a good idea to, again, cut a monument. And this is another image we made. Here you see it from the air in an image. And this is how then it looks on the ground. It's just a muddy, a few walls that are dug in sand, and then we need to excavate it and transform it into an artwork. You see that happening here. And here you see it being excavated. So the 250 meter long structure has been laid bare here. And here you see an aerial picture after the realization of the artwork. This is the sawing blades that we needed to cut it. So in this case, not a diamond saw, but these kind of blades. But we worked with the same cutting company that we used for Bunker 599. Because you really need to trust the people who do this. It's difficult work to do it well, the cutting. Here you see them at work. And here you see a few images of the artwork after it was realized. Again, questioning this ambition to build an indestructible Holland in times of climate change. One of the things that we did was also taking care of other living beings, in this case, particularly mosses and ferns, because it's in a natural area that is very interesting, and there's all sorts of mosses and ferns growing there. And the orientation of the blocks that we cut was chosen such that would be enough shade for the mosses and ferns to grow. Here are some of the biologists studying them, and this is the kind of variety of lichens and mosses that are growing there. And what we did, we sandblasted the entire 250 meter long structure to create optimal conditions for these organisms to flourish. So over time, the artwork will be taken over by them. Now I'm not sure if I need to. I think I need to do it here to give you an impression of how that will look in a few decades. So here you see it becoming taken over time. It's basically anticipating what will be happening here. But so in terms of affordances, it's interesting that by sandblasting the concrete structure, you can create affordances for these other life forms to flourish. I think that's an important message for everyone building. It's not something new, but it's difficult to do it. When you're making something big, it's difficult to also pay attention to something like mosses and ferns, which are not there yet, which are not visible yet. Then finally, I want to show you a short movie of 3 minutes, in my last 3 minutes, and that is a making-of film of the making of Delta work. So that was my talk. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Merci beaucoup.